stay informed of current issues, read reports, and ask questions?
I'm going to say check to that, yes.
And will you commit to the duty of loyalty? As a board member, will you put KBOO's interests first?
Oh, yes.
And will you commit to the duty of obedience? Follow KBOO's bylaws and policies, state and federal regulations, and decisions of the board?
Absolutely, and I am grateful to be asked.
Thank you, Anna. And before we let you go, is there anything you wish we would have asked or that you would like to add?
Well, just thanks for having me on today. And I'm honored to do this volunteer work for community radio, really in general, and KBOO radio specifically.
Thank you for participating in the forum.
Tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive is here. Help us reach our $45,000 goal. Sign up to support us during this critical time for community media, now through September 20th. All you have to do is check out kboo.fm/give. Text KBOO to the number 44321 or mail us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and support Radical Radio together.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Chasing Chimeras, the Lure of Deceptive Climate Solutions, a documentary directed by Barbara Bernstein about climate justice. Screening at Cinema 21 on September 24th at 7 p.m., the film will be followed by panel discussion with the filmmaker. More info available at chasingchimeras.org.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to Film at 11 here on your community radio, KBOO Portland. KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform, which means we are funded by you, the listener. This morning, we're joined by Jeff Godsell to discuss two recent romantic comedies. But first, here is Jeff solo on The Hustler.
When most people think of or remember back to The Hustler, it's the performance of Paul Newman as pool shark Fast Eddie Felsen that comes to mind. But any new viewing of this 1961 classic will reveal that it is really superb on every level. Robert Rossen had spent many nights in pool halls in his youth, and so was well suited to adopt the novel by Walter Tevis into a film. It was a hot property around Hollywood back after it came out in 1958, but nobody quite knew how to structure it into a story for the screen. Writer-director Rossen had the answer for that dilemma by not using a traditional story structure at all. The Hustler opens with Newman as Eddie and his partner Charlie, played by Myron McCormick, stopping at a small town on their way to Pittsburgh, just killing some time and having a beer while they get their car serviced. To the locals in the pool hall, Eddie and Charlie are just a couple of salesmen passing through and stopping to play a couple of friendly rounds of pool. For a little cash, of course. But Eddie starts to drink too much as his losses mount. And Charlie just wants to get him out of there, but Eddie wants to up the ante, get some of his money back. Well, now the hustle is on. And eventually, Fast Eddie and Charlie walk out with a wallet full of cash. This entire opening sequence is mostly pre-credits, pretty groundbreaking for its time. Beautifully shot in black and white CinemaScope, we get a nice first look at Fast Eddie and what makes him tick, as well as the game itself and the special universe that its players inhabit. Paul Newman is riveting. Astonishingly, or maybe not when you stop to think of it, one of the brass at 20th Century Fox actually contacted editor D.D. Allen in the early stages with a strong suggestion to actually cut the entire sequence out, claiming that it didn't get the story moving along. Fortunately, Allen was able to decline the advice. Is the studio ever right? Without ado, we find ourselves in the next establishment, Ames Pool Hall in Ames, Iowa. Up the stairs from the street and through two swinging doors is a massive room with multiple tables. It's quiet in the late afternoon. Like a church, says Eddie. Or a tomb, says Charlie. Those felt-colored tables are the cemetery plots. It is here that Eddie hopes to face the legendary Minnesota Fats. And he doesn't have to wait long, as Fats comes through that door every night at 8 o'clock sharp, as he does on this night. The fat man himself, sartorially splendid in his suit and vest, carnation and buttonhole. Jackie Gleason, in his feature debut, is perfect as Minnesota Fats. His stature, his genial wisecracking, his crackling good pool playing, it's hard to imagine anyone else in the role. Fats and Eddie eye each other, aware of each other's reputation, and get down to business. Eddie's up. Then the bet gets higher. Eddie's winning big. $11,000. Charlie tries to convince Eddie to take the money and quit, but Eddie says it's not over until Fats says it's over. But there's been another guy in the crowd watching the whole time, a high-stakes professional gambler named Burt Gordon, George C. Scott, in yet another star-making role. When Gordon labels Eddie a loser, Fats takes note and stays in the game. Night turns to day. 25 hours and an entire bottle of bourbon later, Eddie's up 18 grand. But his stamina and his luck is wearing thin. Fats wears him down until Eddie collapses on the floor. He's lost it all. Fats calls the game. Later, in their hotel room, a restless Eddie picks up his few belongings and leaves a sleeping Charlie behind. Stashing his stuff in a Greyhound bus terminal locker, Eddie heads to the all-night cafe in the bus station where the only other patron is a woman sitting alone at a table. Eddie introduces himself and she to him. Her name is Sarah, and though she's well-dressed and well-spoken, it becomes clear soon that she's an alcoholic. Eddie and Sarah speak plainly, honestly to each other. Rawson's dialogue is brilliant as they guardedly navigate each other's territory while an attraction grows. We're almost in Charles Bukowski territory here as a couple of lone spirits hook up, connected by the mutual love of the bottle. Eventually, Eddie moves in with Sarah. Far from providing just the love interest in the hustler, Sarah, beautifully played by Piper Laurie, will eventually provide even the moral center for the film. Eddie and Sarah seem to be good for each other, sometimes. But their relationship is ill-defined. Sarah grows to love Eddie, and she can say so. Eddie's not so sure about that, or if he even needs it. Anyway, Eddie's on a mission. To play Minnesota Fats one more time, and to beat him. Eddie runs into Bert again in a poker game where Bert tells him that he's got plenty of talent as a pool player, but he's still a loser because he lacks character, something Fats has in spades. He tells Eddie that he'll need at least $3,000 to play Fats again, and he tells Eddie that he has just enough confidence in him that he would stake him and provide all the expenses for a 75% cut of the winnings. Eddie refuses. Trying to raise the money he can, bit by bit, Eddie plays small games for small change. Until one night he gets cocky and shows off, running the table and taking $100 from some tough locals who don't appreciate being hustled. He gets to keep the 100, but also leaves with two broken thumbs in one of the film's most harrowing scenes. After nursing his thumbs back to health with Sarah's help, Eddie changes his mind. He accepts Bert's offer. First stop, Louisville on Kentucky Derby Day. High rollers everywhere. They wager a bit and win a bit on some horses, and it isn't long before they hook up with a wealthy local socialite acquaintance of Bert's named Findlay for a private game in his basement rec room of his posh home. But they discover that the game is three cushion billiards, not straight pool. "My home, my rules," says Findlay. At first, both Eddie and Bert decline, but Eddie changes his mind, convinces Bert, "Let's continue anyway." Eddie goes down his losing path again, and Bert tells him to pack it in. He won't stake him anymore. But Eddie's anger convinces him to give it one more shot at $1,000 a game. Eddie wears out the exhausted Findlay, walks out with $12,000, or $3,000 to be precise, thanks to the deal he made with Bert. Eddie tells Bert to go on ahead back to the hotel. Eddie's going to walk. Take his time. Feeling like a winner. Bert arrives at the hotel and sees Sarah waiting. And unbeknownst to Eddie, Bert has shown himself to be the scum that he is to Sarah. And while Eddie's away, he uses this opportunity to drive the point home even further. Eddie arrives back at the hotel to discover that the fragile Sarah has committed suicide, leaving no doubt about Bert's complicity. Reset, reboot. Days pass, maybe weeks. We're back at the Ames with the usual suspects, Bert, Fats, the whole crowd. And in walks Fast Eddie. He's there to play Fats, and Eddie places a bet at $3,000 a game, everything he's got. "All you got to do is win the first game, and I'll be out," says Eddie, and Fats agrees. Eddie wins the first game. "I got character now," he tells Bert. "I got it in a hotel room in Louisville. It looks like he's got style, too. It's not Fat style, the one that he admired so much. It's his own. Fast and loose," Eddie says. Eddie runs the table. Fat loses game after game. Finally calls it quits. Bert screams at Eddie that he owes him his cut. Eddie refuses. Bert tells him that he'll settle for half. And if he doesn't get it, Eddie will get more than his thumbs broken this time. But Eddie reminds him of Sarah and shames Bert into backing down. "Just don't show yourself in a pool hall again," Bert says. as Eddie walks out into an uncertain future, but a winner. Robert Rossin had explored themes of struggle and sports before, as he did in one of the best boxing movies ever made, Body and Soul, with John Garfield in 1947. And he was fascinated with the themes of power and success in America, as in the Oscar-winning All the King's Men in 1949, leading some to see a political allegory in The Hustler as a metaphor for making it in America. And Rossin was still reeling from involvement with the Un-American Activities Committee of the late 50s. For years, he had evaded and avoided the committee's attempts to coerce him into ratting on his friends' associations with the Communist Party. But in the waning years of the dark days, they caught up with him. Like others he knew well, like Elia Kazan, he named names. None that hadn't already been named, but it was enough to tar him with the label of traitor by the left, and perhaps by some friends who had not been friends for years. The Hustler was nominated for 9 Academy Awards for picture, director, screenplay, for all 4 of the main actors, winning only for art direction and cinematography. This was, after all, the year of West Side Story. And back then, awards for art direction and cinematography were divided by color and black and white. George C. Scott famously refused his nomination, as he would continue to do in the future, not wanting to validate any arbitrary competitions with his fellow actors. Paul Newman's career was off and running, of course, and amazingly, the role only came available to him because a project involving Elizabeth Taylor was scuttled because of her lingering involvement with the ill-fated Cleopatra. Even more unbelievable was the original choice for the role of Fast Eddie Felsen. It was Bobby Darin. Instead, Darin's first dramatic role would be in Cassavetes' ridiculous Too Late Blues. The Hustler is available in a beautiful Blu-ray edition with terrific special features, including an audio commentary featuring Newman, Rossin's daughter Carol, editor Dee Dee Allen, second AD director at the time Ulu Grosbard, critic Richard Schickel, and others. This is Jeff Godsell for Essentials of Cinema, and I'll talk to you soon.
This is Professor Kitty from the Monday Sampler. Remember that this is listener-supported radio, KBOO in Portland. If this radio station is important to you, please go to kboo.fm/give to become a member. Now, back to Film at 11.
Okay, we're back with Jeff Godsell again, and this time we're going to be talking about 2 movies. He's even gone to the trouble of watching one of them twice. He liked it so much. The films in question, as previously stated, are Splitsville and The Roses. And do you know a lot about Splitsville? Because I believe there's something to do with the 2 writer stars creator.
Yeah, just about everything is only to do with them because they're right. All over this thing, and they've only done 1 previous film, which was The Climb, which was also a short film first, and then this Splitsville. They work together, they co-write, they co-star in both of them. And the one guy, Michelangelo Covino, directs both of them.
Mm.
I have not seen The Climb, but so I came fresh from any expectations or anything. I assume you did also.
And we're comparing and contrasting these 2 films because they do slightly resemble each other, theoretically speaking, in that they're romantic comedies about the perils of relationships, I guess.
Yeah, and oddly enough, that seems to be a concurrent theme right next to the horror genre that is having a run right now, too.
Oh, yeah.
And they both come together.
Yeah. Yeah, the other film is, of course, The Roses, based on the novel The War of the Roses, which has already been made into a movie once before. And I went to the trouble of watching that one. And boy, is it not hold up very well. Not that I ever liked it, but it's even worse than I remembered. We were talking about Splitsville, and then we'll transition into The Roses. Splitsville is, boy, now I suddenly can't remember if it's two couples or it's just a three people.
It's two couples, but one is theoretically in crisis.
Right.
One might argue that as one watches it, but as it starts off, clearly it's the one couple that's in crisis, with him having the confrontation with his wife in the car and him running out of the car and running across the field. And
yeah, never stopping. And the way it's being advertised is that supposedly it's about conducting an open marriage, and the happier of the two couples or is the one that has the open marriage. But as the plot transpires, you learn that they're not particularly happy either.
At all. Yes.
And 13 conversations about one thing, you know, happiness. And is it even possible? I would say that the first one says no. Splitsville seems to be saying no, in that it's clear that it's going to go on from one generation to the next, as in fact it did in the book series, where there was a sequel to The War of the Roses about the kids of the couple.
So it's safe to say that it avoids having a conclusion other than this stuff will just start all over again.
Yeah.
I agree with that. I will say at the outset that I didn't like the film. I rarely even write or talk about films that I don't like very much. So I don't want to pile on, let's put it that way,
on
Splitsville. But it was one of the first things that I encountered with it, as a lot of us did with the previews, is that all of the trailers did not look funny at all.
There's only one time when I really laughed, and that's when they told a joke, an actual question and answer
in the trailer.
In the movie itself.
I think that was not intended. Yeah.
No,
well, I did too once. I wonder if it was the same place, because I've since forgotten.
The joke about trying to make an IKEA.
But there's two then, and I forgot what the other one was. But
oh, I forget too. Anyway.
But I think you'll agree that clearly you were intended to laugh a lot.
Yes.
And there's all kinds of manic stuff going on. And, you know, rather than, like I say, dive in, I had problems with tone. I had problems with pacing. I had problems with how are we supposed to feel about this pretty much throughout. And if you still have all of those issues deeply into the film, one tends to distance oneself.
Yeah.
Characters, and that is what happened to me, but I don't think it completely disqualifies me from being able to talk about it.
No, of course not.
In comparison to the
and film. Also, it just has that indie feel where you're not fully confident that the people really know how to make a movie.
Well, I'm with you on that one too.
Yeah, so I guess we're just really piling up on it, but we did have more pleasant experiences with The Roses. As
yeah,
I said, it's based on The War of the Roses. The book was not a comedy. The book was meant to be serious, you know, a profile of pathology. And then it fell into the hands of Danny DeVito and Kathleen Turner and Michael Douglas. And it starts out being a comedy, but it just gets increasingly more laborious and the people more unlikable.
Yeah, I remember being exhausted at the end of the
movie. Yeah, I don't think the book is like this, but the framing device is that Danny DeVito is a divorce lawyer and a friend of the couple, and he is in his office with a guy who remains silent the whole time, a prospective client who wants his divorce proceedings to go forward, and DeVito is, by illustration with this story of the roses, trying to dissuade him from what would be a hopeless path to go down. That's been scrapped. Good point about the movie is it doesn't exhaust you, and you don't dislike the characters because the performers are winning enough and have such good chemistry, and their problems seem plausible. As in the first movie version, there is a lot of jealousy involved between the two people and make up the couple. And at first, you're not quite sure that's real. And then as it keeps going on, it's more pathological than a serious marital problem that could be solved with a therapist. It's haywire.
Yeah.
This movie, the people are real and funny. And the movie's funny, most important. And they're such a good couple together.
Yeah,
Benedict Cumberbatch and Olivia Coleman, Olivia Coleman. Yes, thank you. But you liked it a lot too.
I loved it, and I adore it now. After seeing it the second time too, not only did I laugh at all the same places again, and I found new ones because really, you will find more. The fast repartee between the two of them, and it's very British also. Mm. You can miss stuff. You could just be laughing and not miss it. They're just going to have it come at you. And rather than feel like you're lost, you just go see it a second time and you'll get it all. It's hilarious. Great. In construction of all comedies, rom-coms especially, the specter of Preston Sturges looms large over all of them because he made the best ones. Not the only ones, but most of the best ones. And especially, in my mind, the Palm Beach story from 42, which was, in fact, about a couple attempting a divorce.
Right.
Not successfully. They come together at the end, but and all of that. And a lot of the problems that one faces in making a screenplay or comedy like this need to be solved. And you can look back at how he did it and look up to my mind in Splitsville, they either didn't know they had to or they failed most of the time in exactly what you said, keeping the characters interesting. Do we care about them anyway? Both of the couples in the two films have kids. I could really care less about the little brats in the first one, in the second one, and especially when they use them at the end to make the point about, they're still little, well, I can't say it on there.
Right.
So nothing changes, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, like, I still don't care about them. That's what didn't change. But in The Roses, they're real kids. They have a role to play. And a funny bit that they get to drop toward the end, not the very end. And so they stay alive as characters. Now, the fact that they're British, of course, gives them all of this leeway to do a whole style of comedy that they alone, and they even comment about that. It's just us, you know, we're British, what can we tell you? They are transplanted Brits, of course. They're in Mendocino, high rent district of Northern California there. He, a very successful architect, also goes back to the Palm Beach story where Joel was trying to get this airport off the ground.
And That's right.
Enlist a rich donor that he could get this his little model of with a little plane coming down and all this. And Cumberbatch has to construct this museum, which is he's very dedicated and has lots of ideas, which. I'm not too many spoilers here because it's early in the film. Doesn't work out.
That's right.
Everything collapses with it. And beginning with that, their marriage as well, in ways that one wouldn't expect. We adore them. They seem so perfect together. And it doesn't happen all at once. Again, very skillfully developed as to what the little cracks are. Now, you know, you mentioned the bickering in the first one. And it just seemed like these people should never have been together, it seems to me, in the first one.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? In this one, you really think, they'll get over this, you know. But in a very real way, I think for anybody that's had any kind of relationships can attest to, things happen. And when things aren't going perfectly, little cracks ensue. And you don't want to pick at each other or anything, but things just appear, and then real problems appear. And all of that is done realistically, again, with other relationships mirroring that. You have two very non-British people in Kate McKinnon and Andy Samberg. They call them their American friends.
Yeah.
They come over and... again, just like Splitsville, they're attempting an open marriage. You judge whether that's working out or not. But
well, one of the big selling points of the Roses is how witty it is and how the actors can really sink their teeth into these great... I mean, they'll be in a bit of a fight, but then they'll unite when something about like a marriage counselor or some other figure is out antagonizing one or the other of them, and then
they hate everybody else.
And that's where you get the sense of hope. Like, see, they can get along,
right? And you want them to.
Do you think that the ending is ambiguous?
Oh, no, I think okay, there's no mistake about what happens.
Okay, okay.
Okay, well, let's just give a shout out to the screenwriter of The Roses, Tony yes. McNamara. Because you know, none of this witty dialogue would have happened without him. He gets sole credit. Now, I am 100% sure that in the filming, both Benedict and Olivia were throwing some stuff out there.
That was right.
But his past work is The Favorite with Olivia Colman. They co-produced it also, Benedict, and Poor Things. He had worked on both of those. So you can kind of get an idea his off sense of humor.
Uh-huh.
I will say right now that I will say he's going to get nominated for an Oscar. I'm going to say that right now. He's going to win or not, that's a stretch, but
yeah,
the screenplay category is still completely uncorrupted by the Academy, and they tend to notice good work, and this is well-deserved. You mentioned that if you want to see it, better hurry, because at least in theaters now, they're about ready to both vanish.
Thanks, Jeff, and we will talk anon.
Thank you.
Okay, and now I'm going to... And thank you for listening to Community Radio KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, keep watching the screens.